This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. In the 2.5 weeks since President Trump announced that the U.S. would withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement, there's been a lot of speculation about how the rest of the world will respond and whether they can address climate change without us. An MIT researcher plans to test exactly this idea with a simulation this Thursday. It's called World Climate Simulation, and it's being run by John Sterman. He's the J.W. Forrester Professor of Management and Director of the System Dynamics Group at MIT's Sloan School for Management. He's sometimes called Dr. Doom for short, and he joins me now via Skype. John, welcome to Living Lab.
Glad to be here, Heather, although I don't appreciate the Dr. Doom nickname, but it is real, so.
Well, maybe you can counteract that stereotype today. Let's start with the world climate simulation. There are plenty of different climate models out there that take into account different aspects of, you know, the climate system, different policies. How is the world climate simulation different from those?
So there's two main ways in which it's different. First, we do use a computer simulation model of the global climate. It takes as input emissions from various countries, and then it reveals what the greenhouse gas concentrations, global temperature rise, sea level rise, ocean acidification, other impacts might be. So this model is complementary to the large supercomputer-based climate models that are fundamental to research in climate science. Those models are essential to make progress on the research, but they take so long to run that they're not very helpful for negotiators and policymakers. Our model has been designed to run in less than a second on your ordinary laptop, and it's completely free. And it's been calibrated to match the behavior of the large models. So it has a different purpose, behaves the same way, but gives you immediate feedback on the consequences of the policies that you might try out. Well, the second way in which it's different is we've embedded that model, which is used by policymakers in the real world. It's been used by folks at the UN, the UNFCCC, the climate negotiating group. It's been used by the United States negotiators, by France and Brazil and China and UNEP and others. But that's not enough. So what we've done is we've embedded that model in an interactive role play simulation of the global climate negotiations. And that's what we're going to be testing out again on Thursday.
Now, you've run more than 600 of these simulations in dozens of countries, more than 33,000 participants. And as you were saying, obviously, this is a great learning tool for negotiators and mock negotiators to be able to immediately get some feedback. But you also collect data from these simulations. And I'm wondering what you've learned from all of those simulations.
Well, let me describe how it works a little bit first, and then let's come back to whether it helps people understand the climate better. So people, either students in a course, business people, policymakers, members of the public, they will come into one of our workshops and we assign them to different delegations. You might be playing the role of the negotiators for the United States or China, India, the European Union, other developed countries or other developing countries. And you get a little briefing guide that talks about what the interests of the country you represent are and some basic data on climate change. And then they negotiate face to face. So they have to go and meet the counterparties. They have to express their desire for what they want those other countries to do. So, for example, the Indian delegation will approach the EU and say, you folks, along with the other developed countries, you created the climate problem. You have to cut your emissions. And the EU and the United States and the other developed nations say, well, we're trying, but you need to cut your emissions because they're going to grow very, very fast with all the coal you're using and so forth. So they have to negotiate face-to-face. And then they have to make short speeches to the assembled group outlining what their action is going to be, just like in the real negotiations where each nation makes its own what's called nationally determined contribution, their own pledge for what their emissions are going to be. That's very much like the real negotiations. Then what we do is we put all of their pledges through the climate simulation model and are able to then show them immediately what the likely consequences of their collective actions might be. Very often, the reduction in global warming is much less than they expected it to be. a typical result might be that expected warming falls by a couple degrees Fahrenheit, which is not enough to prevent us from going over the 3.6 Fahrenheit target that was established at the Paris Accord. And people find that very surprising, and that motivates them to ask questions. Why did that happen? Why doesn't the response make more of a difference? And what else could we do? And what will the consequences be? And we show them. We show them what the science says about sea level rise or ocean acidification or crop yields. And then there's usually a shift from the initial frame where the negotiation feels a lot like a zero-sum game, where if China wins, the U.S. must be losing and vice versa. And what people start to realize is we're all in the same boat together on this. And so they shift from what's called the distributive bargaining frame, zero-sum, if I win, you lose, and vice versa, to what's called the integrative bargaining frame. We're all in this together. We have to create shared value together, and we all rise and fall as one. And then we send them back for another round of negotiations. Sometimes it takes two more rounds of negotiation, but most of the time they come up with a much better collective solution to the challenge of climate change. And there's just no question people find this exercise far more exciting, interesting, and compelling than any lecture anybody might give.
You've been talking about the broad problem of can we stick to or meet the goals of the Paris Agreement, this 2 degrees Celsius or 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit total global average warming. The question has changed a little bit in the past few weeks, and that's, can we meet that goal without the U.S.? Who's going to be participating in this upcoming simulation that you're running at MIT? And do you think it's a group that can help us get some handle on, in the real world, whether or not we can do this without the U.S. in the Paris Agreement?
So I'll be running it this coming Thursday with a group of executives from around the world who are coming to MIT Sloan for a week-long executive training course in system dynamics in our field. They aren't signing up to come to a sustainability class or a class on climate. They don't, I don't believe, even know they're going to be doing a simulation. So that's a good context, because we don't want the people who do this to just be the choir, the people who already think this is an important issue. We are going to try something new. So since President Trump announced the U.S. will withdraw formally from the Paris Accord, I think now 14 states, several hundred cities, many universities and other subnational entities, including many corporations, have stepped up to say, despite the president's decision, we intend to fully comply with the Paris targets or do even better. And so what we have done is we're going to have the usual group of delegates, and we're adding a new delegation, which will be the delegation of U.S. states, cities, and other subnational actors. I came up with this idea the day that President Trump announced the withdrawal. And then, in fact, earlier this week, Jerry Brown, representing that group of states and cities, signed a memorandum of understanding with the president of Fiji, who's running the Bonn conference, the climate conference this November. And they will, in fact, be there for real. So this is actually going to happen. And we're going to try it out in the workshop and see what happens when the U.S. delegation is following the instruction from the Trump administration, but there's a new group there representing these states and cities who are pledged to stay the course on Paris. And we'll see what happens. We're going to run the experiment.
You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with John Sturman of MIT's Sloan School of Management about simulating climate change policies. John, back in March, a group of well-known climate scientists published a roadmap for addressing climate change, what we would need to do to achieve the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement. And some parts of that roadmap were quite broad. You know, we have to have emissions globally every decade for the next three decades. And then other parts of it were very specific and kind of prescriptive. The developed world has to stop selling fossil fuel powered cars by 2030. And I was struck by some of those more specific instances, because it seemed to imply that there is one way that we will get to that goal. Do you think there is one formula for achieving those goals, or are there a whole lot of options in front of us?
First, I agree completely with the authors of that paper that the situation is now urgent. And in fact, many people believe that global emissions need to peak and start to decline no later than 2020, which is quite soon, but certainly between now and 2030 at the very latest. And then they have to fall at a pretty fast clip until we're running a prosperous, healthy economy on clean, carbon-free, renewable energy. This is not a science problem anymore. It is not even a technical problem. It's not an economic problem. We have the technologies. They're getting cheaper all the time. It's not very costly to make this transition. The problem is now a social, psychological, and political problem. There's no one magic bullet to solve the climate problem. Instead of a silver bullet, we have a silver buckshot situation. And that silver buckshot is energy efficiency and solar and wind and a little bit more hydro where it's feasible, and maybe some geothermal and maybe some nuclear if you like that option. And all of these technologies are available today, getting cheaper all the time. And the purpose of rapid deployment for them is to keep the carbon in the ground. We talk about the carbon budget, which is how much more carbon we can spew into the atmosphere before we've passed the level that guarantees exceeding the 2 degrees C 3.6 limit. And everybody needs to understand that 2 degrees C of warming over pre-industrial or 3.6 Fahrenheit is not safe. It's just safer than where we're headed without those dramatic cuts. It reduces the chances of catastrophe. It doesn't eliminate them.
You've called climate change, quote, the perfect storm of chaos and confusion. But then on the flip side, you say the key to addressing this issue is something that you call systems thinking. And you alluded to this. That's part of what this group you're bringing to Cambridge this week is going to be learning about. How does systems thinking, I'm assuming that's trying to consider all of these different options in some overarching way, how does that help us get to a solution for climate change?
So in systems thinking, we try to think about all the different interactions and consequences. So let me give you an example. If people think about transitioning away from fossil energy towards wind and solar, for example, they often conclude erroneously that it's just too expensive, we can't afford it, it's going to harm the economy. If you take a systems view on this, actually, it's the cheapest, best thing you can do, and it often will make money for you. So, for example, the World Health Organization tells us that there's about 7 million people around the world who die every year as a consequence of air pollution. Most of that air pollution arises from the combustion of fossil fuels. And many of those deaths occur in the United States. It's not just China. It's not just India. So if you cut those emissions, there will be co-benefits arising from lower rates of lung disease, fewer cases of asthma that lead to emergency room visits, and morbidity and even mortality. So healthcare costs will go down. Energy efficiency is often free if you think about the offsetting savings. So another systems thinking example is from our own new building at the MIT Sloan School of Management. We built a new building starting around the year 2000. We occupied in 2010. It's a LEED Gold rated building. It uses 70% less energy for heating and cooling than comparable buildings. And it didn't cost more to build it green than the conventional building. Now, how can that possibly be true? Well, yes, we did spend more money on the extra insulation and the high performance windows and ensuring a tight building envelope and so on and so forth. But as a result, we use so much less energy that the HVAC system is much smaller than it would have otherwise had to be. The electrical substation that feeds the building is much smaller than it would have been. And MIT, as the owner-operator of our buildings, did not have to expand our steam generation and chilled water plants to supply all that extra energy that we're not using. When you take those savings off of the extra upfront costs, the net turned out to be 0.25% on a $140 million project. In other words, rounding error, a few hundred thousand dollars. And this included the cost of the sustainability consultants we brought in, the cost of our LEED application, as best as we can tell, it's a very conservative estimate. So the net present value of our sustainability investment in our building is almost $10 million with no upfront additional capital costs. That's a win-win. MIT made money, no change in our cash flow to build the building, and ongoing savings for as long as that building is in place.
You've already said that climate change is not just a technical or technological challenge. It is also an economic, a social, a political challenge, and it is a social justice challenge. And in fact, addressing climate change presents equity and social justice opportunities. Do you think that a systems way of thinking about climate change can somehow bake these social justice issues into our climate change thinking and our climate change policies in a way that it hasn't been to date?
I do. But I think the key point here is that if we stay on the no action path, if Paris unravels, if the U.S. withdrawal means other nations will cut back on their investments in the Green Climate Fund and their commitments, there's nowhere to hide, even for elites. Now, of course, affluent people will be able to temporarily buffer themselves from the worst effects of climate change much better than the poor in any country. And I don't just mean, you know, folks in Bangladesh or Africa. I mean people in Louisiana, Mississippi, anywhere that the poor live, including in the United States. They will suffer first and they will suffer the most. But there's nowhere to hide. And what's so interesting about this is that President Trump's policy of withdrawing from Paris is going to hurt his base the most. There's twice as many jobs in the solar industry alone in the United States now as there are in coal, and it's growing very rapidly. And those jobs, building solar panels, installing them on rooftops, similarly with wind turbines, building them, installing them, operating them, maintaining them, those jobs are here in this country. They can't be outsourced, and they're primarily the kind of blue-collar jobs in the middle of the country that President Trump's base need. And so you have a policy here that is working against the interests of the base. And that base is a group of folks, many of whom are have not experienced an increase in their real incomes for decades, who are facing much higher costs for healthcare, who are struggling often with several jobs, with unstable schedules and no benefits. And these are the kinds of jobs that can really help them out. So, yeah, I do think there's a potential here, but I don't want people to think that this is some set of policies that's only attractive for liberals or progressives. This is a set of policies that is good for everybody in this country, except perhaps people in the coal business or the fossil fuel extraction business.
That's John Sturman of MIT's Sloan School of Management. John, I don't think you sound like Dr. Doom. I think you've got a pretty good handle on both the challenges and the opportunities that lie ahead. Thanks so much for talking with us, and good luck with your simulation on Thursday.
Great. Thanks so much, Heather. And I'd just ask people to go to climateinteractive.org to find out more. Everything we've done is freely available. We'd love to have them check it out and send us feedback.
John Sturman joined us by Skype. I'm Heather Goldstone. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break.